FM dial. Streaming live and archived, baby, at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
I'm Elizabeth Madrigal.
And I'm Karen Morrison.
And we're the hosts of the Women's Mosaic, where the real lives of women and girls are shared and celebrated.
In this space, we honor the feminine and amplify the voices of women speaking their truth.
The Women's Mosaic delves into the real lives of local women through story-rich interviews, learning what works and what doesn't to enhance the health and well-being of women in our community.
We strive to share unique perspectives, resource sharing, and instructions on how to be kind by any means necessary. Welcome to the Women's Mosaic. Today we are joined by Ayanna Nance, an addiction recovery advocate. She shares her lived experience to educate, advocate, and bring hope to others. Welcome to the show, Ayanna.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So to start off our conversation, we'd like to ask you to tell us one thing you'd like our listeners to know about you, and it can be anything.
Can it be multiple things? Because I tried the one thing and it didn't quite
yes.
work.
Yes,
absolutely.
Okay. Yes, we break the rules all the time here.
Okay, awesome. Something I would like the listeners to know about me is that I am Vancouver through and through. I was born here, raised here, and I still live here. My family was actually one of the first Black families to live in Vancouver, so our roots run really deep. I come from a very large family. It's the kind of family that wherever you are, like you know someone, and you grow up surrounded by history and love and a whole lot of lived experience. I am a program director for an environmental nonprofit organization, and I genuinely love what I do. My work gives me a chance to give back to the same community that shaped me. It lets me create opportunities, build connections, and make real difference in people's lives, and that means a lot to me. So I'm also just here with an open heart to share my story, hopefully touch someone's life and let somebody know that they're not alone in their recovery journey.
So with a large family, you can't get away with anything.
Nothing.
Okay.
Nothing.
All right.
Nothing at all.
We'll have to watch ourselves, Karen.
Wow, that's another show all by itself. Wow, you're one of the first families. Are you in the first family's book?
We are, yeah.
I thought so.
Yeah.
So, Ayanna, we appreciate and admire your willingness to openly share your story. Why is it important to you to offer your voice and personal experience?
It's always been important to me, but it became more important to me just to kind of speak about what my family has gone through mm-hmm. and what I survived right alongside them. I lost my brother Curtis in 2023, and it really pushed me to start using my voice more publicly. He passed away of an accidental fentanyl overdose, and it was the day before my birthday, and he was my world. He was like my best friend, my ride or die, as he would say, and so losing him was really, really hard. He tried really hard to rebuild his life after going to jail and facing some homelessness, but the system he had to navigate through wasn't set up for someone in crisis. So there were resources available to him, but there wasn't enough support to help him maintain those resources, and eventually he fell through the cracks and ultimately died from his addiction. And so now I speak because I need to turn my pain into purpose. It's how I protect my own recovery, and it's how I fight for people who are still trying to survive mm-hmm. systems that weren't designed for them in mind.
You know, first of all, we're very sorry, of course, to hear about your brother and can't imagine, you know, the loss that is, particularly since you're young. I'm assuming he's young, so... we're very sorry, and we're very happy that you are doing something to use your pain for power mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. purpose.
Thank you. I'm trying.
You're doing a great job at that, and I especially enjoy being with you when we go to Olympia to advocate
for these type of issues that sometimes are overlooked, especially in the BIPOC community, where they feel like we can work this out on our own. I just sat there and, you know what? You spoke to the heart of people with power that can do something about it. You were courageous, bold, and strong. And I was so happy when I heard your story that you're able to make moves and to save lives that I know you needed to be on our show.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
And she told me. She is coming on.
Here I am.
Yeah. So members of my family of origin struggled with addiction. Was this a bigger issue in your family than just your brother?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Addiction was definitely a part of my story. My mom struggled with it most of her adult life, and she had four children. I was the only girl in the baby, and I had three brothers. And out of the five of us, all of us struggled with mental health and substance use disorders at one point or another. I lost my mom and two of my brothers to addiction, and the only living brother I have is still fighting the fight. So I don't share my story to pass blame or shame anyone. It's the truth about who I am and where I come from. And so by me being able to speak about it, it just kind of helps me understand myself a little bit better, and it helps me advocate for people that are still going through it.
And that's so needed, because everyone has so many different ideas about what it means to have addiction as a genetic or a familial issue.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So it's wonderful that you, the willingness, I think, and the openness is pretty powerful just on its own.
Oh, yeah.
And we don't believe in guilt, blame, or shame around here. We just don't. We believe in help and healing in whatever capacity that it looks like. And it's not the one size fits all.
No, definitely.
I like the fact that you're willing to speak to it, to look at it, but also to look for resources and other ideas that people may not have thought about before, but collectively we can work together to save someone going through addictions.
Absolutely, especially with platforms like this.
Thank you. Families are often bewildered why one family member spirals into addiction and others don't. Are there prevention strategies parents and guardians can use to help adolescents and young adults avoid substance abuse?
Okay, so as a mother of a 14-year-old girl and a 23-year-old young man, I can tell you that forcing our children into doing anything doesn't work. It never works. It's very unsuccessful. So one of the things that I like to practice is being honest and just creating a safe space for my kids to be able to come to me and express how they're feeling. If they're curious, if you know, they're wondering about substance abuse or anything in general, you know, you have to have a safe space where they can speak honestly.
That's right.
And then, you know, when they feel supported and seen, then they're more likely to turn to you instead of turning to substances.
You know, I think so many parents, they're really invested in their kids right up until middle school.
And then let them go.
Okay, I did my bit. Let me out of here.
That's when the attitude comes out. The attitude comes in.
That's why.
Right. And so I think that, you know, it is harder. I know with my oldest, it was so hard. She was so confrontational and verbal and in your face. And it was so hard for me not to, like, go
choke
down
her?
To that. Yeah, to choke her, right. Not to go down to that level where, you know, I was at her state of mind. You know, just to remember I was an adult.
Right.
And the safe space thing, I mean, that was a tough one. And,
sorry.
You know, it's just a stage, parents out there. It's just a stage, I promise.
Mm-hmm. You get through it.
So there are many types of recovery programs, but one common theme deemed necessary that, you know, I've heard forever for a lasting recovery seems to be that an addict must first hit bottom to be able to recover. Does this concept resonate with you, and why or why not?
So it definitely does. I used to use that term a lot. I had hit rock bottom so that I knew that there was nowhere else I could go but up. But I've recently thought about it a little bit more, and I don't know if I completely agree with the statement, only because bottom looks different to everyone. Mm-hmm. And for me, it wasn't one big dramatic aha moment. You know, it was a lot of little mini moments that brought me to a place where I was just like, hey, wait, this isn't for me. You know, mm-hmm. this isn't the life I want to live in. So I feel like when you say hit rock bottom, you know, for recovery to be possible or to maintain recovery, it's kind of stating like you have to be in a horrible state to be able to seek services and really get support. So yeah, I definitely feel like you have to hit a point of no return. You have to be mm-hmm. done, but to hit rock bottom, you know, that could be different things for different people. And some people may not have to hit rock bottom and mm-hmm. they're still in a position where they're going to be successful in recovery.
That's actually very encouraging, because I think, you know, if you are dealing with a substance abuse disorder, do you feel like you actually have to completely fail in your life before you deserve to get any kind of help or to access resources? Is, you know, just another way to stay in the addiction.
And absolutely.
Yeah.
Wow. I like how you describe that it's more like a point of no return, but you can return.
Absolutely.
And the one size doesn't fit all, in some cases doesn't fit most.
Yeah.
So well-meaning loved ones often caretake, protect, rescue, and overcompensate for the person struggling with substance abuse disorder. Can you explain how this can harm someone?
Okay, so caretaking usually comes from love. You see someone hurting and you want to soften the blow for them, but sometimes the things we do to help end up protecting the addiction instead of the person. When we're constantly stepping in and covering up for someone or cleaning up the fallout, it unintentionally shields them from the reality that something needs to change. And I say that with compassion, and I'm not judging. I've been on both sides of that. But when someone is in active addiction, even basic tasks can be very overwhelming, and it's natural to want to jump in and save them from that. But if we're always catching them, then they never get a chance to feel the discomfort that can motivate change. Mm-hmm. So caretaking becomes harmful when it keeps someone from facing the truth about their situation, or when it starts to take its toll on you as somebody that's trying to be a supporter.
You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. We've been talking to Ayanna Nance about her addiction recovery advocacy. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors and then continue our conversation.
KXRW programming like this is made possible with the support of the Columbian. I'm Will Campbell, and since 1920, my family has owned and operated the Columbian and ensured its award-winning news coverage. For the most thorough daily coverage of local news, national news, and local sports, both in print and online, and for subscription information, visit Columbian.com. That's Columbian.com.
KXRW is supported by founding partners Morrell Inc. Print and Marketing. Since 1993, Morrell Inc. has offered high-quality, creative, and innovative solutions from their women-owned, union-staffed, state-of-the-art print shop. Morrell Inc.'s experienced staff uses the latest technology to solve clients' marketing needs and within their budget. Find Morrell Inc. at morrellinc.com. That's MORELINK.com.
Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Today, our guest is Ayanna Nance, and our conversation with her continues.
You know, when they use that term, I don't know if you've heard it, Elizabeth, where they say codependent. Mm-hmm. You're a codependent.
Right.
You're trying to help. You're trying to save a life, but yet they like put guilt on you for trying to protect your loved one. Yeah. And they said, oh, now they're codependent. And I used to question, like, am I making them or their addiction worse by showing all this compassion for what they're going through without actually have gone through it myself? So I'm trying to understand from their lens. And a lot of times people would say, well, you're making them codependent. And now you become the new addiction.
Yeah.
So when things happen, have you heard anything like that before? Or is this like an odd statement?
No, I've definitely heard that. I think sometimes when someone doesn't know what to do or how to help, you do what you feel is right. And, mm-hmm. and oftentimes you do what feels good for you. I was not in my active addiction when my mom and my family members were, and so I have a unique perspective on that side of things as well. Mm-hmm. I used to think that watching them hurt, seeing them in pain, struggling with withdrawals, that was something that I wanted to save them from. But as long as I made it comfortable for them to mm-hmm. you know, go through these things and not want to get the help that they needed, they were always going to depend on that. And so it felt good for me because I knew that I was doing something to give them the shortest way to feeling better, but it wasn't necessarily what they needed. And okay. I think that that's where the line is kind of blurred a little bit. You know, mm-hmm. we think that we're helping, but really it's something that we're doing to make ourselves feel better.
Okay.
And so just being mindful about that and really, really getting help. Al-Anon, there's resources out there for folks if you want to know how to care for a loved one. And it is hard. It is so hard. Mm-hmm. It is very, very hard. And you blame yourself. You feel like I am the reason why they are in this position a lot mm-hmm. of times, which then puts you in a deeper stage of kind of denial. Mm-hmm. And so first thing, easiest thing to do is put a Band-Aid over it.
That's right.
Well, you know, it took me a very long time. I have a sister who struggles with mental health issues and previously with, you know, substance abuse. And I really thought I was just being selfless and helping her. And I felt, you know, very committed to that. I was very concerned about her. I really hoped that I was helping her, and I thought I was. I was mm-hmm. rescuing her. I was caretaking. I was in denial. But I was really in denial about what I got out of it. And what I got mm-hmm. out of it was feeling like the hero.
Yes.
I mean, I hate to, you know, I'm ashamed of it when I think back, like, oh my goodness, you know, I had no idea at the time that it also fed some need in me to be, you know, the savior. Mm. And I was very, you know, I mean, I was very anguished over it, and I couldn't see that until one day my husband said to me, you know, I don't think you're really qualified mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. do that. And I was like, what? And then he was absolutely right. She needed real resources, a real right. therapist, mm-hmm. you know. So I'm really glad that, you know, you have validated that, you know, you may think you're helping, but maybe you might need professional help.
Yeah.
You know, for yourself and for them.
Yes.
But also for yourself. So how can a friend, an employer, or a family member support an addict without enabling them?
Supporting someone without enabling them is really about loving them in a way that says, hey, I'm here for you, but I'm not going to partake in you harming yourself. I'm not going to support you in situations that put you in danger or keep you stuck in your addiction. And that can be super hard, you know, because someone you love is struggling, your instinct is to fix it, smooth it over, and kind of rescue them. But real support looks different for different people. It looks like listening, you know, listening mm-hmm. without judging, you know, listening without trying to control the outcome, which kind of goes back to what you were saying.
Right.
You know, we have this idea of what the right thing is. And so when we offer support, sometimes we are shaping it to what we think is right and what we think they need. And a lot of times that's more harmful. Just making sure that you're creating a space where they can try to be honest, you know, be honest with them about what you can do, what you can't do, what you mm-hmm. will do, and what you won't do, just setting those boundaries. You know, it's compassion with boundaries, you know, for lack of better terms. You're walking beside them, you're not dragging them, they're not dragging you, and it's just a mutual path that you're taking together. And sometimes the most loving thing you could do for somebody is to step back just enough for them to really get a feel for the weight of their mm-hmm. own decisions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, while still reminding them, hey, I'm still here for you, but you got to let them travel that road alone sometimes to feel that. And that's the balance that helps people, you know, keep moving towards recovery and not getting stuck in their addiction.
You know, absolutely, my heart is hurting as you're saying yes. all of this.
Yes.
Because I know how hard that is, you know, mm-hmm. to step back as the one who loves the person. And it's hard enough being the person with a disorder, but to be the person that, you know, has no coping mechanism, really, right. And you're suffering because you love the person. I mean, honestly, I can feel it all again. I can feel, yes. you know, how hard it was to be dealing with that and not feeling like there was a real, you know, solution that I had access to. I mean, right. I didn't know what to do. I was completely lost.
Right. And I didn't come to the realization of what support or how I enabled my family, you know, until I was in their shoes. And then mm-hmm. I learned, I got all the mm-hmm. tools. So it wasn't until then that I realized what I was doing, you know, and that it wasn't necessarily the best thing for them.
I wish I would have had those tools that are out there now when I was raising my son and not being sure, you know, here you are, the single mom, working two jobs, going to college, and you have this child that you can't fix.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, you know, feeling the guilt, like, what do I need to do? Where do I need to go? And there just weren't as many resources at that time that are out there now. So this is great news to hear that things did change, and we did learn yeah. from things that didn't exist, and they exist now. You describe yourself as a recovery advocate. What does that mean to you and the community?
For me, being an advocate is really about making the pain that my family felt, like, not a waste. You know, I don't like to just talk about addiction. Like, I really want to help to invoke change. There are a lot of systems that are failing people, you know, and mm-hmm. I want to be able to identify and hopefully change the system to where people aren't getting left behind, and making sure that people are able to get services where they're being met where they are and not expected to do, you know, some astronomical amount of, you know, tasks to maintain eligibility for programming mm-hmm. or to actually seek, you know, services and navigate through the recovery resource system. So when I advocate, I'm fighting for things to be different. You know, I'm fighting for the policies to make sense, you know, for the services that don't punish people for being mm-hmm. sick, for compassion to be built into a process instead of being added as an afterthought. I want to help create a world where people don't have to hit rock bottom to feel like right. they are worthy mm-hmm. of help, and where families don't have to bury their loved ones before, you know, the systems change to actually meet them where they are and get them the services that could have saved their life.
Saving lives. I mean, yeah. it is, this is such a sensitive subject and such a deep problem in our society, because there is a lot of unhappiness and there is very easy access to a lot of substances. So can you talk about your own path to addiction and recovery and some of the challenges and opportunities you experienced?
Yes. Okay. So I wish I could say that one day I just kind of woke up and was like, oh, yes, you know, mm-hmm. just addiction. I wasn't able to track, you know, where my story kind of went left. But my addiction didn't just appear out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. It came from a period where I felt like everything was falling apart around me. I had lost my mother. 5 months later, I lost my brother, my home. I pretty much had just the basic clothes mm-hmm. on my back. And so I was kind of struggling to maintain normalcy for my kids. I thought that if I were to cry, I wouldn't stop. Like, I literally thought that I would mm-hmm. stop myself from crying, because I thought that if I started, I wouldn't be able to stop.
Right.
And so, you know, I know now that that's an irrational belief, but that's how I felt in the moment, you know? And so I was just really trying to, like I said, maintain normalcy for my family and just trying to numb the pain. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the way to keep me from, you know, falling into a depression that I couldn't get out of.
Right.
And surprise, surprise, hey, numbing yourself doesn't fix anything. Mm-hmm. It just kind of prolongs
it. Are you sure?
Temporary.
Not much I'm sure about. And that's one of them. Yeah. And that's definitely one of them. But eventually I was, in a little bit of legal trouble. I was facing an 18-month-long prison sentence, and my attorney approached me with an opportunity to opt into what's called the DOSA Drug Court Program through District Court here in Clark County. And so I accepted, and what that looked like was 90 days of inpatient treatment in Spokane, Washington. And Lord, was that an experience. That's an unforgettable experience. And then after that, I returned to Vancouver, where I did some intensive outpatient and regular outpatient treatment at Community Services Northwest. I also had some different court reporting and, you know, mandatory UAing that I had to meet with a probation officer. And it took me about 2 years to complete all the phases of the program, but I did it. I graduated March 17th, I believe, of 2017. That's when I graduated the program. So, yeah, I joke about it being like a lot of structure. I was kind of hard-headed, and I didn't understand the rules. I thought that because I was sober, that's all that mattered. You know, I was right. Like, what are these other rules for if I'm clean, I'm not using, I'm not doing anything. So why are you punishing me? And I bumped heads with the judges that overseen the program quite a bit. But now I thank them because they really did save my life. It was the structure that I needed. Mm-hmm. I felt like my life was unmanageable. You know, it was sheer chaos. And so that structure gave me something to kind of hold on to at a time where, you know, everything was swirling around me. But definitely looking back, the structure was great. Also, the people that I met when I was there, that helped me build my recovery network. Unfortunately, you know, if we had a class of 15, there might be three of us that have maintained recovery. There have been a couple of us that have lost their lives as a part of relapse in their recovery journey. But building that network while in the different programs that I was in through DOSA, it really helped me, you know, secure the people, my people. Because once that legal obligation is over, once you no longer have that accountability over your head, it terrified me. I remember being terrified graduating the program because I'm like, who's going to make me pee in a cup? Right. Who's going to, you know, who's going to hold me accountable? You know, I don't have a prison sentence hanging over my head. And I did it. You know, I did it. I've done it pretty well, I think. And so it was a struggle. So having the people that I could rely on, it's, you know, that's kind of what held me up. It's definitely the reason why when I talk about recovery and when I talk about advocacy, like it's not theoretical. Like this was my story. Like I lost everything. I rebuilt from nothing. And here I am today, you know, 10 years strong in my recovery. And so like I'd like to always share that because it's real. You know, my story is real. Right. I've faced it on both sides and it's real. It can happen. I think just putting that out there gives people an opportunity to really see themselves in a position of seeking recovery treatment or getting other help that they need. So,
well, I think, you know, coming from a family that is easily addicted to anything. I mean, I was addicted to cigarettes when I was 13, and you know, the first time I smoked a cigarette, and I saw the addiction of other substance abuses in my family. You know, on both sides. What I really didn't think. I mean, I always knew I had an addict's personality. I never doubted that. I just knew from my early experience with cigarettes and trying to quit cigarettes. And so I think one of the things that does happen to a lot of people is that they do think it's not going to happen to me, particularly if they've seen it in the family.
Yeah,
they think, absolutely. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going there. And you know,
it's, ta-da!
Yeah, ta-da, that's right.
You are listening to part one of our interview with Ayanna Nance, an addiction recovery advocate on the Women's Mosaic on KXRW. Part two will broadcast in 2 weeks.
For more information about addiction recovery and treatment referral services, you can also call the free SAMHSA's, and that's SAMHSA. National Helpline at 1-800-662-4357. And that's our show. New episodes broadcast on the second and fourth Tuesdays, but you can stream any episode online anytime.
We are so grateful to our guests for sharing their knowledge and life experiences with us in their support of the health and well-being of women and girls.
So until next time, be kind by any means necessary.
And remember to honor your power.
Support for X-Ray comes from Beeline Urban Delivery. Beeline supports businesses with access to zero-emission delivery, warehousing, and advertising services. More at b-linepdx.com.
Did you know X-Ray FM has a newsletter where you can stay up to date on everything the station is doing and some of the coolest events in town? We cover concerts, programming to watch, station updates, and plenty more. Stay in the know by signing up at xray.fm/newsletter.
Hey, my name is Amber. I support X-Ray FM as a member by making a monthly contribution to the station. Monthly donations sustain the station and listeners, make up the largest source of revenue for X-Ray FM. Plus, your donation is tax deductible. Consider joining us as a member today by visiting us on the web at xray.fm and hitting the big blue donate button.
Today we meet some of the lead actors from the Metropolitan Performing Arts production of the play Footloose on this episode of The Common Good. Hello and welcome to The Common Good, where we showcase the achievements of members of our community that contribute to Southwest Washington and beyond in a positive way. Hello, I'm Stephen Glickman, your host for this episode of The Common Good. My guests today are featured actors from the cast of MPA's production of Footloose. We have Ace Alexander, who plays Chuck Cranston, Ethan DeLay, who plays Willard Hewitt, Lucy Cantwell, who plays Rusty, and lead actors Aidan Heffley, who plays Ren McCormick, and Bella Burr, who plays Ariel Moore. First, I'll talk to Ace, Ethan, and Lucy. Well, we have a whole bunch of actors here today. We had to split them into two groups. First group is going to be Ace, Ethan, and Lucy. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Hey.
Hi.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah,
thanks
for having us.
So this is the third time I've interviewed MPA actors. And the first two times they did plays where someone died. I mean, you guys are doing Footloose. Nobody dies, right?
Yes. This is to say.
It's... I mean, I guess you can't, like, improvise and just be like, oh, alas.
I mean, we sure could, but there'd be some plot problems that would arise.
Yeah.
So so let's start with Ace. For the listeners at home, Ace is to my left. What's your role in this play?
So my role in Footloose, I'm playing Chuck Cranston. He's sort of this kind of aggressive, pretty angry kind of guy. He's Ariel's abusive boyfriend, and he's really anti-dance.
Yeah, I just think this is totally teed up immediately. Like, if he started dancing, he'd be less aggressive. It would help him with his emotional regulation.
Yeah, yeah. Footloose for him, for all of us, really been thinking about, like, when do you let go and when do you accept dance and when can you, like, have fun and be yourself? And, you know, throughout the show, we don't really have that with Chuck until the very, very end and the very final number when Chuck finally gets to dance with everybody. So it's a really awesome, like, not quite homecoming, but it's nice, like, coming to self.
Mm-hmm. Is this, you've done plays before at MPA?
Yes, several.
What characters have you been in the past?
My most recent, I was the leading player in Pippin, and that, I think, has been my favorite experience throughout Metro. I was in the ensemble in Newsies, which was, I think, one of our best shows.
You played Pippin?
I was leading player. Pippin and leading player are two different characters.
Okay. So who gets to sing... what's the song I'm thinking? It's like...
can we try to guess?
It's Rivers Go Where They Can Ramble.
Oh, yeah. That's Pippin.
Yeah. That's a great song.
Fantastic song. Incredible song.
So you got to stand near that.
I did.
That's really...
I got to just kind of stand and pretty much watch the whole show, which is really, really awesome. As like the MC, I got to see everything that happened on stage every night.
I think on Broadway, Ben Vereen played that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ben Vereen originated the role.
Which is kind of crazy. I've been around for too long. Ethan, what's your character?
So I play Willard Hewitt. And Willard is sort of this, like, very kind-hearted guy, though he's a little dumb at times. He is very, like, a very kind person, but also, like, kind of meets a lot of situations with just, like, violence or, like, just physical, like... means. So and I feel like Willard also has a lot of like thoughts that he wants to speak, but like has a hard time articulating things, which is something that I really struggle with as well.
Okay, I was going to ask you, like, you know, where is the meeting point between your character and you? Because you seem like you would not have some of the problems that he has. But you're saying that you're, are you really shy and retiring?
No, I wouldn't call myself like a shy person, but like sometimes I have a hard time like speaking what is actually like in my brain. So like I know I like hear like what's in my brain and like how I kind of want to say it, but it doesn't articulate well when it comes out. And I feel like I find that similarity in Willard as well.
And but Willard doesn't die.
Willard does not die.
Which is, which oh, I'd be so sad if oh, it was ended what, with Willard.
Now, were you
he would
in,
like sacrifice himself though, I feel like.
Was it Alice by Heart? Were you in Alice by Heart?
I was not in Alice by Heart. Okay. So while everyone else was in Alice by Heart, I was actually doing something with my school. I was in The Mousetrap, which is a murder mystery play.
Yes, it was incredible. I saw it twice.
Yeah, the set was gorgeous.
Mm.
That's quite the endorsement. Mm-hmm. So you guys, this is almost like the Artemis mission. Like you guys are close, you know, a lot of connection.
Yeah, really we've been together for several
long. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lucy, what's your role in this?
So I play Rusty. She is Ariel's best friend, kind of the second female lead character. Big kind of force of energy in the show. She's loud, she talks fast, and she's got a lot of opinions, and she's Ariel's like right hand man in a sense. Like that's kind of her MO is to be the friend.
She's a girl's girl all the way.
Very much a girl's girl. Yes.
It's kind of crazy because everything that you guys are talking about is like they're teenagers in high school. They have a lot of energy and feelings they don't know what to do with.
Oh, for sure.
And they're not allowed to dance it out.
Especially in Footloose where like the whole show explores this like big thing that you're not supposed to talk about, which is someone does die in Footloose. Four people die in Footloose.
Oh, that is right.
There is some exposition with a couple people dying in Footloose, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that is such a relief to me because I hate to think that kids are going to be in plays where people do not die. Now, you were in Alice by Heart, right?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And because I like sometimes the people in the plays jump out at me.
Mm-hmm.
Later, we're going to have Aiden come up, and he jumped out at me
literally
in a play before he did Alice by Heart, where he had a more major character and he came in for an interview. And this is going to be a second one. So when he comes on, he's going to have to be, he's going to change our lives.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
His answers are going to be so illuminating. And so no pressure on you. You guys do not have to be.
Oh, yeah.
No, at all.
We're kind of the openers.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, we have
no.
The easy job.
He can clean it all up. Easy.
Okay, so let's take a step back. Let's reel back the years, go into Time Machine. What were you doing before you joined MPA? You know, what got you to MPA? So, Ace?
Well, I have to say, I can't remember a time when I wasn't with MPA. I'm coming up on 12 years with them. The first thing I ever did with Metro was dance boot camp with Shannon Jung, who is the choreographer for Footloose. And then my first two shows I did at the same time at
Wait,
7
is
years
Shannon's
old.
Younger sister Molly?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
Shannon's
so
younger sister
I'm
Molly.
Getting to know you guys really well. So you basically were birthed out onto the stage.
Pretty much. The second that I was conscious for a summer and childcare became really expensive, I got put in theater and then I never left. And I love it so much.
That's really, what do you like about it?
With Metro specifically, my favorite parts are the education and community aspects. I feel like it's really easy to be a theater company, but because Metro has so many kids coming in and out and so many people stay for so long, there's a really great focus on what you can gain from shows and the learning that comes with that. You're not just learning dance, you're not just learning music or how to memorize lines, you're learning discipline. Being able to keep yourself accountable, to memorize all of these things, and then to be able to be part of a larger community and ensemble, to create art and put it out for so many people, that is really, really important, and I think so special, especially with our new building.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the first things I said to Chris when I walked in was like, this feels like Metro Academy. There's a huge focus on education with classes and within shows that I think is really, really important. And the friendships, obviously we have a room full of people who have become really, really tight-knit. And even bigger than that, like the whole Metro community is like a family. We spend so much time together and we grow and learn so much. that, you know, you walk in and walk out a totally different person for every yes. show.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ethan, how long you been with MPA?
So officially, I've been with MPA for about 5 years.
So a newcomer. New kid on the block.
Yes.
Have you broken
no.
through to, like, have you gotten, you know?
Oh, yeah. So the first thing I actually did with MPA was back in 2016. I did a little, like, dance camp as well. But then I didn't go back for a really long time. And after COVID, I was like, I really want to get back into theater again. And so my family, like, looked at Metro again, and I started doing summer camps. And then I got into shows. And then I essentially just never left for 5 years.
Summer camps are really the gateway, huh?
It really, really is the gateway.
You like the connection?
I love the connection. I think some of my greatest, greatest friends have come from Metro, and I really do value a lot of them.
All right, Lucy, it's up to you. They've talked about how great MPA is. Is it inclusive? Do people feel a pressure to lift others up and not tear them down? Is this a really supportive environment?
Oh, very much so. I'd say one of the biggest facets of MPA is that there isn't a lot of sort of people that don't want other people to succeed, mm-hmm. you know? Or at least they will try to get over it quickly, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There not a lot of hard feelings persist very long, but mm-hmm. So that's, like, one of my favorite things in the whole wide world, is that there's not a whole lot of debilitating drama in the drama.
And you've been with MPA, I'm assuming, like, 30 years before you were born. You were still, like,
she's 75, believe it or not. Wow. She looks
yeah.
great.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. No, it's just skincare routine. No, I've only been here for 4 years. No, a little shorter than Ethan, but my gateway was also a summer show. I was in Matilda,
yes.
and then COVID.
Wait, was that our first show together?
Yes.
Oh,
uh-huh. God.
That's incredible.
No, I was the pigtail girl.
Oh, my God.
For
yes,
parents listening at home, just know it's the gateway. You
yeah,
know, like,
it's
oh,
the gateway.
Just over the summer, you'll dance. It'll be something for you to do. And it's the next thing you know, theater kid.
Yeah, yeah. Lifelong mm-hmm. gift.
3 weeks is all it takes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I didn't go for COVID, and then I came back. My first show back was Lightning Thief.
Yeah.
And that was
me too.
A lot of fun. And again, I've never left. I haven't missed a show since.
How was Lightning Thief as a play? I mean, the book was great.
It's,
the first movie was not good.
It's like if you took the book and you flipped through all the pages really fast.
Yeah, I feel mm-hmm. like it was a nice synopsis of the story.
Exactly, yes.
But it was definitely the book with a bunch of dance numbers.
And it's very funny.
I do think it is better than the original movie, because that movie is...
Anything's better than the original movie.
Truth.
Yeah.
I don't like to speak negatively of anything, but that movie was trash.
It was pretty bad.
Oh,
I was very disappointed.
Oh, complete garbage.
Yeah, I will say, I was Percy Jackson in the musical, and I will say I was not pleased with the character in the...
Oh. Okay, time's up.
Who said that?
But so when people come to see the show... Really quickly before we end this segment, like, what do you, and any one of you could take this question, what do you want the audience to get out of this?
Can I
please
say
do.
Something?
Yeah, do.
I want people to understand that Footloose isn't just a show about people who can't dance. It is a great exploration of grief. It is the fact that people cannot move on, they cannot move, is because the town is stuck on the deaths that we mentioned earlier, the deaths in the exposition. Yeah, it's like so intrinsically rooted that this town cannot move on, and it affects all of our characters in different ways that are explored. So I really want people to keep an eye out, and when they leave, they think about, like, maybe what they're holding on to.
We talked a lot in the beginning about how Footloose is like camp as a musical, but mm-hmm. it's like serious in story.
Very much so. Yes, yes, yes.
It's got to really resonate with you as actors who are like, this is all about tapping into emotions. And here are mm-hmm. some people who are like bottled up, stifled emotions.
Yes.
And it must, when you actually act out the relief, it must be so cathartic for you as actors.
Truly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for giving us your take on it. And when we come back, we're going to have even more people.
Yay. So,
thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you
so much.
I'm Stephen Glickman, host of this episode of The Common Good on KXRW Vancouver 99.9 FM. My guests today are actors from the Metropolitan Performing Arts production of Footloose, which will be staged at the Magenta Theater in downtown Vancouver.
I've been talking to Ace, Ethan, and Lucy. When we return after the break, I'll talk to Aiden and Bella.
Support for KXRW comes from Kindred Vancouver in downtown Vancouver, Washington. Kindred is a community-focused general store offering bulk refillery options and supplies for sustainable, do-it-yourself living. With a focus on reducing waste and supporting clean, mindful lifestyles, Kindred helps individuals incorporate low-impact choices into daily life. More information is at kindredvancouver.com.
KXRW programming like this is made possible with the support of The Columbian, proud to be Southwest Washington's leading news source. Since 1920, the Campbell family has owned and operated The Columbian and ensured its award-winning news coverage. For the most thorough daily coverage of local news, national news, and local sports, both in print and online, and for subscription information, visit Columbian.com. That's Columbian.com.
Welcome back to The Common Good on KXRW Vancouver 99.9 FM. I'm your host, Stephen Glickman, and my guests today are actors from the Metropolitan Performing Arts production of Footloose, which will be presented in mid-May of 2026. Before the break, I talked to Ace, Ethan, and Lucy. The conversation continues with Aiden and Bella.
All right, well, so we're back again, but this time we have Bella and Aiden. Now, Aiden and I go way, way back.
At least a year.
I'm actually going to go right to left for me, which I hope I'm not throwing people off at home. But Aiden, you were in Alice by Heart.
Yes.
And then you were in Fame. Weren't you in the chorus?
Yeah. Yeah.
So is this a lateral move from Alice by Heart? Is this a similar size role, or is it a little bit more punch?
In terms of like emotional depth, definitely a step back, but in terms of like screen time, that's a huge step forward.
And what's your role in this now?
I am Ren McCormick, the Kevin Bacon of the show.
Wow, so you, all eyes on you.
Yes.
You're ready for it. I'm sure you're ready for it.
I've been ready for it.
Yeah. This is now I was not going to say like, oh, I, you know, people should probably go to this show, and kind of I might not even be able to say that, probably FCC, but now that I know that you're going to be the lead guy, you know, new to town, nobody's dancing, you're like, I'm really good at dancing. What's wrong with these people?
Yep.
You've been with MPA for a while, right?
Like 11 years, 10 years.
So not like a long time, like 12, but just like 11 years. 11,
yeah,
10, 11
yeah, I'm
years.
No ace. I'm no ace.
And you enjoy it? Or is this like a punishment that you can't get out of?
When you love something and you dedicate so much of your life, doesn't it become a punishment at some point?
Yeah, but if you're doing it right, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you get it.
Yeah.
Is there anything about this role, getting into this role? I mean, you get the role, you're like the lead guy. What was there any surprises or things you didn't expect?
Well, huh. I feel like this role is just so weirdly complex. Like the way that the script is written really took the movie and said, what's about that? Why does Kevin Bacon, his God-given name, want to dance so much? Why is he so obsessed with this idea? And I feel like that there's a lot of interesting moments that me, the director, Shanae, and plenty of my co-stars, where we just found those moments and how to make it more complex, how to bring another layer to it.
I mean, a movie, you know, obviously it's moving pictures, but it's got to keep moving. If you have a scene and it grinds the movie to a halt, it's no good. But on a play, you can grind things to a halt and really focus on character development. It sounds like that's what's happening in this production of Footloose.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. There are some scenes where it's just kind of electric, you know? I know that Bella Burr here, a good friend of mine, we've definitely been working through some stuff.
Yeah.
Well, this really comes down to it. It's like, Bella, what's your role?
I play Ariel Moore, who is like, everybody in town talks about her because she does so much terrible, like, attention-seeking stuff. But I really have come to love her so much.
It's like the preacher's daughter.
Yeah, the preacher's daughter.
There's a lot of her in you, I think. When I look at you, I'm like, that's Ariel.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. attention seeking.
Well, I mean, you're in the right place for it. I mean, you're in a lead role.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You don't have to say, look at me, things. Because people have now paid for tickets to look at you. You don't have to say, like, ooh, it's like, they get it.
Yeah, I know. My ego is out of this room.
Is this the first big role that you've had?
This is the biggest role I've ever had. The most amount of songs, lines. Oh my gosh, so much work. But
and you've
it's
been
so
with
beautiful.
You've been with a MPA for how long?
3 years.
Oh, so you're like a new.
I'm the baby of the group.
So of course this is your first big role because yeah. You just walked in the door.
Yeah. Yeah. I joined Metro in 2023 with Newsies. I played Mike the Newsie.
Nice. Yeah. So did you see this coming and be like, oh, I want this, or did you, or just they were like, yeah, you'll be this role, and you're like, okay, and then
When Footloose got announced, I cried my eyes out. I love Footloose so much. I love the musical so much. And I knew I either wanted Ren McCormick because he just has so much beautiful, beautiful lines. And
why,
like,
thank you. Thank you.
The character depth is insane. But Ariel has my heart. I love her so much. The story the things she goes through is so beautiful. And I'm so excited I get to tell that story.
And I think that you have definitely been MVP day one. Like, when you've been the one that just like, hey, we should go run lines.
We should
go hang out outside of rehearsal and let's run our songs until our ears bleed. You know, it's always you.
I have definitely been very wanting to run everything all the time.
Well, I could just tell, you know, for anybody listening, the other actors in the room, when Aiden was like, oh, you've been nailing this from day one, we almost had to call an ambulance because the head shaking in agreement was so vicious and so emphatic.
Lucy, are you okay?
I think Lucy's going to be all right. Aww. She was seated in a really good chair, so I think she's going to...
Thanks, guys.
Since you guys are the leads and we have a little bit extra time with the two of you guys, Aiden, are you a senior in high school now?
No.
You are a junior in high school.
Junior.
Oh, yeah. So you're going to be just more MPA.
Yep.
Where do you see this taking you?
I don't know.
What are you going to do for the rest of your life? I want every 5-minute intervals just to lay it all out.
Everything I
want
to do. Well, I eventually I want to go drive to Taco Bell by myself. That'd be fun. Maybe start a movie at one point.
Let's start in a movie. Realistic. Drive to Taco Bell by yourself. I mean, let's not get too carried away.
To get a driver's license first.
So,
yeah.
Are you thinking that you want acting to be a part of your life moving forward, or you really want it to be your life?
Is there an in between of those two things?
Yes, absolutely.
Like, most of your life, because I feel like you got to have a balance in everything. And recently, I've learned that Metro all the time can be very debilitating and very degrading. I love it, and it's an incredible experience for anyone who wants to do it, and whoever is just like, man, I have nothing to do, and I want a community, I want people. But just taking a step back, and I know that as the lead of the show, it's like, oh, but I didn't do the previous show we did, Pippin, and I feel like that really helped me get into a certain mindset to actually do a big role, the leading role of Ren McCormick.
Well, you know, acting is, you know, it's really easy to empty the tank. And if you don't have someone to fill it back up again, you're in trouble. If you figured that out while you're junior high school, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah. And all it takes is great people that you work alongside, like Bella Burr here, everybody.
Bella, what do you... Is this the thing where, like, I found my thing? I think I'm going to really run with this for a while? Or
I think theater is my thing. It's, I don't know, acting. I love to act. But I know I could never go, like, a year without theater. I will always need to be in theater forever and always.
What is it about theater that really speaks to you?
It's the telling of a story that you wouldn't ever think. It's the community. It's pushing yourself farther than you think you could ever go. It's so many beautiful things.
I think that one of the, you know, Broadway people will talk about, you know, money is driving Broadway. And mm-hmm. people put millions of dollars into shows. They have to get millions of dollars in return. And I think that people bemoan that it's, you know, just it's got to be blockbusters all the time. But the other thing is they're trying to compete with movies. So they're like, oh, have special effects, make it really exciting. But the thing about the theater is it's a live performance by humans for humans. It's about the human experience. And I think that people need to take the time to let that bloom and not force it to be some kind of like exciting spectacle. And I think that's why you like the theater, is it's because it's humans touching humans.
Yeah, yeah. It's my favorite form of art. It's just so pure, you know?
Well, in the show, it's definitely humans touching humans.
Oh my God. Well, that's why they're not allowed to dance. You know?
Yeah.
I think Footloose is so... A lot of people know the movie, and I feel like the movie does not do the musical. Like, it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
The musical is so in-depth. It gets into the after effects of this tragedy, and it's how we recover as humans and move on. Or lack of moving on.
I think that Ren is the exact opposite of what this town has been going through.
Yeah.
Where the town says, no, we need to stop. We need to stand still. He is this person who has been running his entire life to truly find himself. And when he's given this opportunity, this golden light to really go out there and do something and be a part of his community, to be a part of himself, to really say to people, hey, it's me, and I want this, this, and this. I want to dance. I want to be heard. I just want. And that is such a great thing to have in a character, because having a strong driving force in a show really brings it full circle. And there are so many great moments that if you come see the show, I'm not going to spoil it here, you got to come see it, that are definitely going to blow your socks off, your sunglasses off, but only those two things, because those are the ones that makes everything appropriate.
You know, the Earth is spinning at about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, hurtling through space, and some people are like, what a ride. And I think that's Ren's character.
Yes.
This is crazy. Let's party. And everybody else is like holding on for dear life. And what you're holding on to is already spinning wildly out of control and hurtling through space. So it's like the quicker you can get to like, let's embrace the journey, the better. And that just seems like a really, I don't know that the movie was like, oh, you shouldn't not have dancing, but I think the play sounds to be like embrace life, don't stop, because you're going to miss something if you stop.
Yeah, there are definitely,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, I'm taking up too much time. Do you have anything to add?
I think that's a beautiful way to put it. That is exactly what happens. It's, yeah, it's just time has stopped. People want to move on, but we just can't, and so we need somebody like Kevin Bacon to shake it up.
Yep.
Yeah, and then people are going to be like 6 degrees of separation from Aiden Heflin.
Just wait.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming in today and talking about the play, and there'll be information about how you can get tickets.
Buy the tickets. Do it.
Please.
It's going to be really fun.
It's going to be so good.
It's at the Magenta Theater.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, you heard him. I mean, you can't argue with that.
You've been listening today to The Common Good on KXRW Vancouver 99.9 FM. I've been your host, Stephen Glickman. I'd like to thank my guests today, Ace Alexander, Ethan Dulay, Lucy Cantwell, Aiden Heffley, and Bella Burr. To learn more about the production of Footloose and Metropolitan Performing Arts, or to donate to their organization, you can visit metropolitanperformingarts.org. More information about the show will be provided in this episode's description. Programming like this is made possible by your generous support. If you'd like to support this program and others like it, please visit us on the web at kxrw.fm, and there you'll find the big donate button. Together, we're discovering Vancouver's voice.
On behalf of show creator and producer Joe Clemens and all the volunteers and supporters who make this program possible, I'm host Stephen Glickman, and I want to thank you for listening to The Common Good. Take care.
Talk and civics during the day, arts and music in the evenings and on the weekends. We call it the mullet model, and since 2014, volunteers at X-Ray have been working to put a microphone to the best and most distinctive of Portland, and to make media more open and inclusive for all. Thank you to all the volunteers and members that support the station. Find out more by visiting us on the web at www.xray.fm.
This is Ross Beach, host of Alive with Pleasure, inviting you to join me every Friday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. Pacific as we decipher the live music listings, put sounds to the names we see on those show posters, and otherwise become slightly more hip to the